Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Aiken City Council meeting of April 11th, 2011. We thank you and appreciate you being here. And as usual, as we go through our agenda, if you'd like to speak on any particular item, just raise your hand and be recognized by the chairman, and you'd certainly be allowed to speak. As we begin our meeting, we'll have council prayer and pledge of allegiance. Almighty and gracious God, we come to you this evening with praise and gratitude in our hearts for the many blessings you bestowed on our community. We give thanks for the opportunity to serve on council. We thank you for our citizens who are with us this evening and those who will give willingly of their time to serve our city in so many important ways. Tonight we ask for your wisdom and guidance for our council, staff, and citizens as we conduct the business of the city in service to our citizens. Be with us, Lord, as we discuss the issues before us, and give us the guidance we need to make the decisions that are in the best interest of our citizens and community. For it's in your holy name we pray. We give you the honor and the glory. Amen.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Are there any additions or deletions necessary to the agenda this evening? I do have one. It has to do with guidelines for participation at city council meetings. And I'd like to add it at the end of old business, if you will. Do we have a motion and a second to approve the agenda?
I'd like to make a motion to approve it, Mr. Mayor, with the addition.
Second, Mr. Mayor.
Okay, any discussion? If not, show of hands, please. All in favor? Passes unanimously. Under the minutes, the consideration of the minutes of the work session of March 21st, 2011, and the regular meeting of March 28th, 2011. Any discussion on that? If not, do we have a motion and a second to approve?
So moved, Mr. Mayor.
Second, Mr. Mayor.
We have a second. Okay. All in favor, show of hands, please. Passes unanimously. Okay. Under old business, first item has to do with appointments to boards and commissions. Mr. Pierce, please.
Thank you, Mayor. We have 13 appointments pending that need to be made to our boards and commissions. Council will recall at our last meeting that, Mayor, you recommended Royal Robbins to the General Aviation Commission to fill the unexpired term of Bear Woodrum, who resigned. So for Council's consideration tonight would be the appointment of Royal Robbins to the General Aviation Commission.
Okay, thank you, sir. I move that we appoint Royal Robbins to this commission.
Second.
Okay, any discussion? If not, show of hands, please. Passes unanimously.
And Mayor, did we have any other appointments for next meeting, which will be April 25th?
Good question.
Okay. I can nominate Dr. Ken Covage for the Housing Authority.
Okay. Any others?
Yes, Mr. Mayor, I'd like to renominate Patricia Andringa to the Arts Commission and Robert Besley to the Building Code Appeals Committee.
Okay. Very good. And I'd like to nominate again, reappoint actually Kristen to the Arts Commission. Kristen Brown, excuse me. Okay. Very good.
Were there any others, Mr. Mayor?
Are there any others? I think that was about three. I think that's,
yes,
that's it.
Okay.
Second item is the second reading and public hearing of an ordinance to annex property at 127 Cedarwood Park. Mr. Pierce, please.
Thank you, Mayor. The title of this ordinance is an ordinance to annex to the corporate limits of the city of Aiken certain property consisting of 0.7 acres of land, more or less, owned by Dent and Jane Moore and located at 127 Cedarwood Park, and to zone the same residential single-family RS-15. Mayor and Council will recall we had this at first reading at our last meeting, and Mr. and Ms. Moore would like to annex into the city, and that's what's for consideration tonight. It was approved on first reading at our March 28th meeting.
Okay, thank you, sir. This is the second reading and public hearing of this ordinance, and if there's anyone in the audience that would like to speak on this issue, you certainly may do so. If not, it's back to City Council for consideration.
Mr. Mayor, I move we approve an ordinance to annex to the corporate limits of the city of Aiken certain property consisting of 0.7 acres of land, more or less, owned by Dent and Jane Moore and located at 127 Cedarwood Park, and to zone the same residential single-family RS-15.
Second, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. Any discussion? If not, show of hands, please. All in favor? Okay. Passes unanimously. Item 3 is a second reading and public hearing of an ordinance to amend the city code regarding issuing permits to peddle or solicit in the city of Aiken. Mr. Pierce, please.
Thank you, Mayor. The title of this ordinance is an ordinance revising Chapter 28 of the Aiken City Code to require the Department of Public Safety to check criminal histories prior to issuing a permit to peddle or solicit in the city of Aiken. Council will recall at our last meeting when we had first reading on this ordinance that currently anyone who comes in for a solicitation or peddling permit at public safety must be issued that permit. The change to the city code allows Chief Fromer or someone at his direction to conduct a criminal background check, and if someone has a criminal history, particularly involving a felony or violation of any law or ordinance that involves dishonesty, that on those grounds the Director of Public Safety can refuse to issue the permit. And that's the change to this, and that's for consideration tonight, is approval of the ordinance to amend the code to allow public safety to have that power, and this is second reading.
Okay, thank you, sir. It's second reading, public hearing, so if there's anyone in the audience that would like to speak, you may certainly do so.
John Wade. I've got several questions and need clarifying. In 28.1, in A and B, where it states in the first sentence, it shall be unlawful for any person not having an established place of business in the city. Shouldn't that be reworded to not having maybe a city business license? Because you've got people that have businesses in the county that have city business license, and if I read that correctly, then that's going to eliminate them from being able to solicit business.
If you could ask your questions, we could certainly have the city solicitor come forward, Mr. Wade, and answer those questions.
Okay. That's one question on, and that's for A and B. On E, and that may be a legal term I don't understand, but in the first sentence it says it shall be unlawful for any person whether or not he has an established place of business. Does he reference to women also? Is she?
And again, we'll have the city solicitor address those, Mr. Way.
Then on the Exhibit A on the new section on 28.2, some clarification on that. On number 7, for such activities to be conducted at a location privately owned, a letter from the owner granted permission for such activities. But if you're going to solicit it to a group of people in a neighborhood, they aren't going to call you and say, come solicit to me. So how's that going to affect someone that wants to go from door to door, even if they have the permit? Number 8, on the criminal activity, how's that going to be determined at what level your criminal activity is and how far in the past that you'll be able to have this peddler's permit? And that's on 8 and 9. And number 10, and I definitely need a lawyer to verify this, but when it talks about the code, if the person is previously convicted of a felony, if I understand some of the federal laws now, anything that holds a 30-day sentence in jail would put them as a felon. If you got caught reckless driving, if you wrote a bad check by accident, I think you still classify as a felon, and I don't think that mistakes in that case should keep someone from being able to solicit business just because it was a mistake. And I will say, and I do fully understand what you're trying to do with this law, and I will say that years ago, before Alzheimer's was well known, my grandmother paid someone $10,000 to cut rake her yard. And so I understand that, and I have had customers that have paid a lot of money to people that were out just to get their money. So I'm not opposed to it. I just need some clarification on these and want to make sure that they're not limiting some people that have good intentions.
Certainly. And Mr. Moore's here. He's our city solicitor and would handle the cases in city court, so we'll let him address those.
I got some of them. By felony, we're looking at the definition under South Carolina law, and certainly no 30-day offense would be considered a felony. I know what he's, in some situations, the federal government will take what's a misdemeanor under state law and for their purposes interpret it as a felony, but it doesn't work the other way around. And we're looking at what would be considered a felony under South Carolina law. But I know where he's coming with that. A lot of things like criminal domestic violence, which carries 30 days in South Carolina, sometimes the federal authorities will treat it that way and say, well, a person can't have a firearm, even though it's a misdemeanor under South Carolina law. So we do not interpret that in the way that the federal government does.
Is there a generic definition of a felony in South Carolina?
In South Carolina, there really isn't. There's not clear delineations. It's what the legislature labels a felony. And some states will say any crime that carries 1 year or more, or 3 years or more, or 5 years or more. In South Carolina, you got to look at the individual crime and see if it's classified as a felony.
But if public safety does a background check, does it tell them if the crime, if there is a felony conviction, does it list it as a felony conviction?
What it does is it lists the actual charge the person was convicted for, and then we can look at whether that charge is considered a felony.
So public safety would have the ability to do that then?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
But we don't, yeah. In short, yes. But we wouldn't leave it to the NCIC printout to tell us whether it's a felony, because like I say, particularly the federal government is likes to turn state laws into felonies for their purposes. Okay. So we definitely would not do that.
Ben,
yes.
Suppose there's someone from another state that comes in representing a business out of state, and it's considered a felony in that state. You would know that from the printout?
Once again, you'd have to look up what they were convicted of.
Right.
And find out whether it's considered a felony. Now, what we would do is really make look at it from a South Carolina perspective. To be fair, you can look at, well, let's say in another state, burglary wasn't a felony. Well, it's a felony here. You can look at the equivalent crime and determine whether something's a felony or not, and whether it would be considered a felony in our state. But different governments consider different things felonies and misdemeanors. Because, for instance, in Georgia, if you're convicted of, I believe, something over a year, everything that carries over a year is a felony. And that would have some of those lesser crimes that would not be felonies in South Carolina.
can you address some of Mr. Wade's other questions?
Sure. The he language is what was in the code before. It's considered to apply to all people. As you can see, it was from the 1980 code, but legally he refers to both genders. Trying to remember the other...
Number seven, talking about the letter from the owner granting permission.
Okay, that would not apply to someone going door to door. This is more of a situation where, let's say there's a business parking lot and someone owns that parking lot, whether they could go out there and be soliciting out there in front of that business or shopping centers, it would be getting permission from the owner of that, not a door-to-door situation. So it wouldn't affect people going door-to-door at all. I believe he mentioned people with business licenses as opposed to an established place of business in the city. That is something that council sets the policy. We could do it where it's just business license, or we could keep it the way it is and allow this privilege to people with established place of business in the city. One of the advantages to doing that, if you know, you certainly have a better handle and on locating and dealing with a business that's located in the city as opposed to one that may be far away. Once again, that's really a policy issue for, I think, council to do. There's not a legal reason why you couldn't do it one way or another. You could have it either way.
I'm not sure I understood the question, but is the question whether or not people soliciting in a city need a business license or not?
No, sir. His question under 28-1A, it says it shall be unlawful for any person not having an established place of business in the city to peddle without a permit. And what this basically means is if you already got a established place of business in the city, the permit requirement doesn't apply to you. But it would apply to anyone who doesn't have an established place of business in the city. And Mr. Wade brought up the, I believe what he brought up is why not have it as everyone who has a City of Aiken business license, regardless of where they're located, be allowed to not have a permit
to peddle. A peddler's permit.
Right.
And then the concern would be that it would be possible for anybody to get a business license, so they may circumvent the statute by virtue of getting the business license only and not the peddling permit, since they are going to go door to door.
Right. And you may have a business that briefly gets a license that's out of state that's maybe harder for us to account for if there were any issues.
And the business outside the county, the way you have this drafted, Ben, if somebody has a business outside the city, they're okay coming in and doing business. It's that actual solicitation door-to-door that they would require the permit.
Right, and they can still do that. They just need a permit, which is free. Right.
That doesn't stop them from advertising, though, in the paper or being in the yellow pages.
Absolutely not.
Kind of
this
thing.
Is...
Well, as it's written now, does a business within the city that wants to go door to door, do they need a peddler's permit?
No.
I thought the question here was if you're located in the county and you have a city business license. Is that the question, John?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. If you have a city business license and your business is located in the county and you have a license to do business in the city, do you have to get this permit?
You would, as it's written now.
Simply because you're not in the city, not physically in the city?
That's correct. It just says established place of business in the city.
I think we're running the risk of a problem here. I've always thought that if somebody wants to solicit at my house, I want to see their permit, and if I don't, my next call is the public safety's. But what you seem to be saying is, as long as they have a business and license and they're located in the city of Aiken, they can knock at my door anytime.
That's correct. That's how it's been drafted since 1980, and that's the way we've been doing it. Obviously, you know, it's for council to decide.
I have to say, it's never been a problem.
It's never.
Solicitations are always with the kids, sometimes coming from out of town, hitting the neighborhood,
right,
knocking on every door. I don't think I've ever had a licensee in the city come knocking on my door for something.
Ben, is this a severe enough problem to modify our code and to create this issuance of this law? And what are the consequences if someone is in violation of this?
Well, we would have...
They're a felon, if they're caught peddling.
They would be issued an ordinance summons, and it would carry potentially the same penalties as any violation of the city code, which is 30 days or a fine up to $500. Public safety, Director Fromer, believes the issue of people with bad, severe criminal histories peddling in the city is a real problem.
So it's
he's experiencing right now, he gets the information where he can run the check. He's been running the checks. The people come up with bad records, but the way the code currently is, there's nothing he can do to prohibit them from soliciting through all the neighborhoods in Aiken.
Well, these folks target certain neighborhoods. You hear my colleague said that he's not had any issues with anyone knocking on doors. They know the folks to prey on, and I think we need to, we're pretty much aware based on what's happening, the areas that they're targeted. But is a law required to handle the problem?
Well, without the ordinance change, Director Fromer and Public Safety
have no authority.
They have no authority
because
it says, you got to give us this information, and that information that we currently get under the ordinance allows us to run a criminal history check.
Okay.
But it doesn't allow us to do anything if the results are, wow, you know, not so good. And the way it's currently written, it's, okay, here's your permit. They realize that person's going to be peddling, but there's nothing they can do to stop them. And that's really the whole issue and this whole genesis of this change that we're recommending.
Councilwoman, at the last meeting, Chief Fromer was sharing with us that, you know, in just doing some research on backgrounds, that there have been pedophiles that's been allowed to solicit here in the city of Aiken. There's also been some with criminal histories as far as burglaries, and then you've got these folks walking through a neighborhood with the right to be there and pretty much casing the houses from that standpoint. They walk through these neighborhoods time and time again within a given week, and you know this just gives them the opportunity to know when someone's home, when someone's not home. So these are the kind of things that I think we're trying to get a handle on before they become a problem within the city of Aiken. And I don't think that any of this has happened with businesses that's been located within the city or within the county from that standpoint. But you know as well as I do, we have people who come in from out of state during the summer, and they just start canvassing neighborhoods. And we know nothing about these businesses. We know nothing about these individuals that are walking, going house to house. And it could very well be an elderly lady that opens the door and should not have. And
I've seen them all of my life. They've knocked on our doors when I was growing up. They still knock on my door. They ride bicycles. Some of them are on foot walking. Times have changed, I know. We're more conscious of the dangers than we were. We innocently thought that these folks were just trying to earn a living. And I recognize, based on times and changes and the economy, people are hungry to feed themselves, and they'll resort to some violence, possibly to get something to feed their families, to feed themselves. So I recognize all that. I just wondered, just ask the question in terms of the penalty and violations, and whether, given the numbers, whether we needed to modify the code to give our folks some authority to do something. And you've answered the question in terms of our officers, and the chief does not have any authorization to do anything without this code change.
When you issue one of these permits, is there a time limit on it?
I'd have to. There currently is not. That's something public safety can do administratively. So I certainly see your point of giving one in perpetuity and they later get a record. So I think that's a good policy for public safety to start doing.
As a senior citizen, I don't have a fear of being preyed upon, and I still maintain the right to open my door to anybody who rings my doorbell or not. And one of the things that presents itself as a handicap for me is that I don't have a window next to my door to see who's ringing my doorbell. I've got a tiptoe and try to make out who's there. But my concern is this: if you have a city business license and you don't have to have a permit, and somebody comes to my door or someone else's door and say, I'm working for this particular business, that may not necessarily be the case. You know, people do. If they're dishonest to begin with, they're going to be dishonest
right,
to start with.
Right.
And so I'm saying, what are we hoping to accomplish by leaving such a large hole in this?
Right.
And if it's a simple matter of just being able to do a background check and that's all we're doing today, then, you know, I'm for that. But I just wondered,
if they were to misrepresent, they say, I work for a business located in the mm-hmm. city and I'm doing this on their behalf, and we find out that that is incorrect, they would be violating this ordinance.
But I would have to make that call. I would have to pick up the phone and call
that is true.
Someone
that
and say true. That that's going on before anything would
that's
be done.
Right. And that's
and so I just want to make it very clear that this is not a cure-all for some of the things that I've seen over the years. I mean, you know, I do get a lot of people.
And we realize there aren't
yeah.
cure-alls, but we believe this would really help.
Okay.
And
yeah, there's no perfect ordinance. I agree with Councilman Wells. I mean, the focus is on the people that are just descending upon a neighborhood. I think our citizens need to understand, number one, that if you're going to do soliciting, you ought to have a piece of paper that says you're allowed to. And I think public safety ought to be able to tell folks with bad records you're not going to solicit in Aiken. And I think that's all we're trying to get done with this. It seems fine to me.
And if we find out later down the road that we need to make some changes, we can always do
yeah.
that.
Yeah. We might want to consider a time limit, I should point out, with that.
Yeah, I've been to know that. Yeah. Staff, right?
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, it is. Very good idea.
And fit with the expiration date. And I just want, Mr. Mayor, it was brought up last time about people, let's say someone running for office coming around. This would not apply to candidate for political office, a religious organization who are just handing out material constitutionally. There's been a number of cases, but we cannot prohibit that. But as long as this is specific about soliciting goods, services, and so forth, and asking for donations, they're just coming to spread whatever their message is, they have a right to do that. And if we were to pass an ordinance restricting that and requiring a permit, it clearly would be unconstitutional based on the cases I've been reading.
So, Ben, let me just make sure that I understand what we're trying to achieve here. If someone leaves a flyer on my porch, I am to call you to make sure that that person is legitimate?
Public safety.
Yes. You being public safety.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Now, if it were a flyer merely with a political message or a... let's say a religious message, and it's not asking you to buy something.
Now, this is a flyer with someone saying they're marketing their business.
If it's business, if it's commercial, yes. And we would have the ability to say, okay, this, you know, public safety has the ability to have their permit to know what they've issued. And obviously, if they have not issued one, it would merit investigation.
I had a message.
Yes, sir.
I don't know how they solicit around here. I mean, where I live, supposedly you don't have solicitations door to door. But is it like a team that works in the neighborhood? Because a lot of times, you know, they actually mark the sidewalks. This has been covered and all that. Does every member have to get a permit? Or is it a quote-unquote group?
We do it by person so that we can check every individual.
So if there's like five people doing it, you're going to issue
five? Absolutely, because usually, you know, the person owning the business may be fine, but some of the people soliciting for them may be the ones with the records. And the owner may not know that, you know, obviously. They can't run an NCIC like we can, and the person doesn't volunteer it, they may not even know.
Ben, I think it's a key point here that probably most of the people that are going to be out there soliciting are not going to know about this ordinance. So if they do come to the door or leave something, then it's a person. I had this about 3 weeks ago. Call public safety as soon as you can, you know. Because it's fine for us to sit here and make an ordinance, and how are they going to know the people soliciting? Maybe Pete's got the answer. I hope he does.
And I did want to follow up to Ben's question. If we get somebody like Ms. Price, you say they come to your door and they leave something, and you call us and tell us about it, we're not going out there and hunt these people down and charge them for violating the order. What we do is if we can still find them in the neighborhood, we will do that, and we will educate them and inform them of what the ordinance is and tell them they must go apply for a pepper license. Pretty well, the only time we charge somebody is if there's a group in a neighborhood and people call us and we go and find them. We tell them what they must do to be in the neighborhood. And if they, let's say an hour later, we see them in another neighborhood and they have not done what they were instructed, we're usually charging.
Okay.
Ben, I have one other question. You talked about constitutional solicitation with a religious purpose and a political purpose. One of the frustrations is in Woodside. Woodside is perfectly within their rights, I assume, to deny the right to go door-to-door to seek votes. Is that true?
I didn't specifically research that, and it would be their private.
I mean, it's a covenant. So.
Yes.
It's a covenant.
Yes.
They can do it.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I checked that a little more. I did notice there were some cases involving like homeowners associations doing that. Since they didn't deal with municipalities or political subdivision doing, I didn't really read them, but there is some cases on that I did notice. So it would merit a little further research.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
John, did that answer all your questions?
Pretty much it did. It just seems to me, and I agree with my mind went blank.
Dick Moore.
In his simple assumption of what this is, I totally agree, but I don't read it and perceive it as that simple. It seems that it's a little bit too open-ended and needs some points closed. Number 7, I think, is too open-ended, getting Ben's description on parking lots, and I, my perception of what he was saying is parking lots and not someone's home. I think some of that needs to be spelled out a little bit better. And his definition on what felony is and how that should be spelled out, whether you're looking at a federal or a state or how it's perceived. Like I said, I'm not against it, but I think that there's some stuff in here that's just a little bit too open-ended and needs to be clarified.
Well, do we agree, Ben and Council, do we agree that these points should be addressed in this ordinance that Mr. Wade has mentioned? And we could do this, we could still pass this with the understanding that we'll add whatever needs to be added to these issues.
Mr. Mayor, there's one more question. Somehow or another, how is it left to Chief Frommer's discretion whether he's going to issue a permit or not? I'm not too sure that, you know, that could stand legal challenge. I mean, just because you have a record doesn't mean that you know, you're automatically deprived of that privilege.
I think every time a police officer has the opportunity to issue a permit or issue a violation, he does have the right to use his discretion as to whether he issues that violation or not. I mean, that's a...
Yeah, but I mean, I understand he's going to issue a violation. He's issuing a permit.
Right.
Well, you know, if I walk in and I want to sell Life magazine or whatever still sells, and somebody else has a criminal record, he wants to do the same thing. If I get my permit and he doesn't, that's not equal treatment under the law. I mean, once you're finished with the penal system, with your penalties and probation and what have you, you should be treated just like you're starting from scratch, aren't you? Shouldn't that be?
It's not necessarily, depending on the violation, you know, federal law now says you can't own a gun anymore, even though you served all the time you were supposed to serve. I mean, there are liberties that are taken away from you as a result of having been charged with a crime, even though you've served the time associated with that. You still don't have the right to do everything you used to be able to do. Ben can probably address that a little better than I can. But
for instance, felons not being able to vote, people on the sex offender registry for the rest of their life. These are certainly common. Equal protection, you're talking about similarly situated individuals, and yourself and the convicted felon are not apples and apples. You're apple and orange. You're not the same because of that. So, and the other thing the courts look at, is this a reasonable restriction based on public safety and so forth?
And Ben, certainly somebody who has been convicted of a felony or a crime involving dishonesty can apply for and receive a pardon to have their civil rights restored,
this
to take them out from underneath that.
To me, it just seems a little bit arbitrary.
Well, actually, it's really a bright line. If you are been convicted of these types of offenses, you're not allowed to have a permit, so public safety would not have the discretion to issue it. It's not like they can say, well, I'm going to let this felon have a permit and not that felon. It's a bright line, and it's really saying unless it's unlawful for these people with the types of convictions listed have a permit, everyone else is eligible. So it's really does not leave public safety with much discretion.
Back to my question. Do we need to address the points that Mr. Wade addressed or not? And I mean by addressing them, add them to this ordinance.
I think it would be appropriate to clarify those. I don't see any problem doing that.
Ben going to do it? Okay. You will do that?
I'd be glad to do that.
And council accepts that, and we could vote. If not, we'll continue the item, if necessary, to the next meeting. But
I'd just like to see a copy after you do it. But I think we can vote to approve it. Just I'd like to see a copy of it.
You've got in the record the concerns of Mr. Wade. If it's whatever council would care to do, but certainly we could include it in the issues memo to you in the next pack. So you'd have.
Could you enumerate what we're going to change for me?
Sure. We're going to clarify
number seven.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that we're going to clarify is what we mean by felony.
And a time frame.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Or an expiration of the term.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So those three.
Do y'all want to give Ben the guidance on whether the permit should be good for a year, 2 years, 3 years?
I think, why don't we ask public safety what their thoughts are? Pete, you're still here.
You know, I look back at the permits I've issued, and I'd say probably the longest one has been for 6 months. Most of them are usually like 2 or 3 months, because most of them are in the summertime. Just like the city manager said, when you get these folks from out of county and out of state, right, I mean, during the summer months.
What so, would you prefer?
So I say, personally, I'd say 6 months.
Okay.
No more than 6 months, and then they have to renew.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Do we have a motion? Is anyone else who wants to speak on this issue first? If not, back to council. Do we have a motion and second?
Mr. Mayor, I'd like to move that we approve this ordinance with the clarification and with the time frame of 6 months, and that it become effective after the changes, after the clarifications.
Okay. I'll second it. Any discussion? If not, show of hands, please. All in favor? Okay. Passes unanimously. Okay. Good. I asked to have an item added at this point in the agenda, a very important issue. It has to do with guidelines for participation at city council meetings. And for the sake of time, I'm going to read what I've written just to try to save a little bit of time. As we always have, we want citizens to have discussions on agenda issues that are important to all of us. But in order for everyone who wants to comment and get their message heard in an orderly fashion and in a reasonable time period, we must have guidelines and structure to our meetings that we all, council and citizens, work within and abide by. We've had guidelines for participation in council meetings for many years. They're located outside as you come in, usually on the table. They're also located at some of your seats on the back of the agendas. But we haven't always used all of the guidelines. We've used most, but not all. Based on the last two public meetings and at various other public meetings in the past, and also comments and thoughts expressed recently by city council members, including myself, it is time to put our meeting guidelines into full effect. I know council members have got copies of the long-standing guidelines with their agendas as well, but others may not. Some of the others of you may not have them at your seats. So I'm going to read what I think are the major points in the guidelines.
so that we all are clear, and for the record, we're clear of what we're talking about. I'm going to skip over some of the verbiage. This is a formal meeting. Our meetings are formal. It's official business, and we ask, please be respectful of others, treating them as you would like to be treated. Personal attacks and derogatory comments directed to individuals are not allowed. And that goes as far for ourselves, our staff, and our citizens that are here and choose to participate and speak in our meetings. Generally, City Council meetings follow certain guidelines developed over the years to assist with both the flow of the agenda and to ensure citizen participation and comment. We welcome your involvement in the City Council meetings and request your consideration of the following. Public comment is allowed during the first reading of an ordinance as City Council discusses in open session whether or not the issue should receive consideration by the city. Public comment is also allowed at second readings. All other items on the agenda are also open to public comment. If you would like to be recognized to speak on the agenda, on an agenda item, please raise your hand and be recognized by the mayor or the chairman, whoever is conducting the meeting, when the mayor asks for public comment. On issues that may generate a great deal of controversy, the city does provide sign-up sheets for anyone wishing to participate. We encourage you to sign up in advance if you wish to speak. You don't have to, but we encourage that because it gives us information, gives us names that we don't have to, we might have a problem getting when the speaker gets up at the mic. After recognition by the mayor, speakers should approach the microphone at the podium before speaking. Speakers should state their name and proceed with a brief statement. Comments should be limited to 5 minutes. Now, if there are larger issues, larger groups here, certainly council can certainly extend that time. We're not trying to cut people off. We just want to have a meeting that we want to have people talk about the issue, not keep talking about it necessarily, but plan what they want to say. Say what they want to say, and then if there are questions by council, certainly they can come back up if they're recognized again. In order to allow opportunity for everyone who wishes to address council, speakers should limit their comments to the subject being discussed. There are occasions where we tend to drift off maybe on a little rabbit trail, but we need to stay with the issues. Also, the mayor may limit discussion on any particular issue, particularly if many residents have subject being discussed, have signed up to speak, excuse me. Comments should be limited to no more than 5 minutes. And they are the main items that I wanted to get, and I will repeat the first one and probably the most important. Please be respectful of others, treating them as you would like to be treated. Personal attacks and derogatory comments directed to individuals are not allowed. Are not allowed. Please understand that these guidelines that the City Council establishes, not the mayor, it's the City Council establishing guidelines, whether they be what I just read, what we've had in existence, or whether after this, you know, we may want to take a week or two to discuss more and change or whatever. It's up to council to determine what these guidelines would be. But they can be changed, of course. They can be modified as necessary, so that we can have the most productive discussions and exchange of information and the best use of our time. Time is very valuable to all of us, and we know that. For information purposes, I've checked with three other public organizations, councils, within 13 miles of us, and two allow 5 minutes per speaker.
One allows 3 minutes per speaker, or 15 minutes per group. One also allows a longer time. Didn't get the time period, how much this other particular organization allows for a group. One allots just 30, 40 minutes total minutes for public comment, no matter how many people are there to comment. We've never done that, never intend to. One group requires sign up prior to being at the meeting, prior to speaking. All groups are somewhat flexible with the time to speak depending on the issues. I personally think that the following these guidelines will allow everyone to know what is to expect and also what is required of them to participate in city council meetings. And the result will be a more productive meeting and outcome. Now, at this time, I would like to ask council if they have any comments. How would you like, it's up to us, how would you like to handle this issue of participating in city council meetings?
Well, Mr. Mayor, who's going to enforce it? First of all, the time and when somebody gets out of kilter, so to speak, you know, beyond
the mayor? The mayor? Or the chairman, who, whichever you want to call the person sitting where I am. That's the way these other councils do it. Some of them also, I didn't say this, but some of them have clocks. We don't have a clock. I've got a watch up here, but we've never used a clock. We've never really wanted to. But over the past year, I would say we've had situations where we needed to be able to move on, to have a productive meeting. We don't need people pointing at other people saying what they think they're going to say. We don't need people criticizing other people. If you want to do that, you do it outside the doors. This is city council. It's official business. We're here to conduct a meeting and do it as well as we can. Listen to our citizens. We've always listened to our citizens. We've never, in my 25 years on council almost, we've never turned away anybody that wanted to speak. We've listened to people for a long time, over and over again. Now, if council thinks that's what they want to do, I'm here. I'm willing to stay. I've been here till 11:30 sometimes and even longer. So have some of you council members. But it's up to city council collectively to make a decision. We can run with this. We can enlarge the time period. We can do whatever we want to do, is use this as a baseline. Or we can start all over from scratch. Yes, sir.
I would add to Mr. Homoki's question, I would add, any council member during the discussion, if any council member feels that someone is being out of line or just having an inappropriate discussion during the meeting, any council member can, you know, bring that point to the attention of the mayor. This doesn't seem. I don't think she's saying something or he's saying something that's appropriate here, Mr. Mayor. I don't know how the rest of council feels, and that can go as a motion that someone's out of order. So any council member can bring that to the attention of the mayor during the discussion if they desire to do so.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let me make a comment, Mr. Mayor. I support what you're trying to do. I agree with it. I think, however, we need to recognize that citizens have the right to complain about departments, about functions, about processes in the city. We have probably been distracted by those complaints being personal, which has frustrated a lot of us. But I hope we are not trying to tell our citizens that they don't have the right to tell us when they think we're doing something wrong. I think they do clearly. I have been frustrated, as many of us have, when we have the dialogue between the audience and the council. I would like to see us get to a point on an agenda item where we close it to public hearing. We give the public every opportunity to say what they want to say, and then we close it to public hearing. We have our discussion, we take our action, and we go to the next item. I don't like, quite frankly, people standing up in the audience and getting into a dialogue. I think it's disruptive. But I think we do need more structure of the council, and I support what you're doing. But I think we need to give our folks the right to tell us that they think we're doing something wrong with this thing or that thing. And again, let's not personalize it, but that's why many of them come here.
Yeah, well, I certainly didn't mean to indicate that we're not going to listen to the public.
Yeah. No, I know you didn't.
It's very simple what I read. I'm going to read it again. Please be respectful of others and treating others as you would like to be treated. Personal attacks and derogatory comments directed to individuals are not allowed. Now, if that's telling, that's not telling people they can't say this, that, or the other. It's just being respectful. And derogatory means a lot of different things, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I think we're all pretty thick-skinned up here. What we got to be careful about is when they start jumping on some of the city employees like happened in the past.
Absolutely.
I think we can take care of ourselves pretty much, but it's not fair for somebody to go up here and actually criticize some city employee who's not really here or can't defend themselves, so to speak. But as far as the times go, I think we should have some flexibility on that. You know, I think basically calling, once the person starts repeating themselves, like I am, that's exactly right. And I think basically you should point out, is that, are you making any other further points? And if not, then mm-hmm. thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mr. Mayor, I suggest that we accept what you've said, and it's pretty well all been written down. I mean, I spoke in front of city council many times before I was elected to council, and I think the 5 minutes is more than ample in today's world. It's three bullets on a page of paper and four or five words a bullet, and after that nobody's listening. So I think the 5 minutes is more than ample, and I suggest we go ahead on with our meeting.
Mr. Mayor, I'd also like for us to go ahead with the 5 minute. That does give people ample time. If they plan on speaking to council, they can certainly plan out what they're going to say beforehand and get the important part of it to us. Councilman Dwar, we're not in this, we're not saying that people cannot share their complaints with us. I think what we're dealing with here is the manner in which they share those complaints with us. You know, I think they can do it in a very respectful way and a very nice way and still get their point across. So I think the manner in which people are sharing their complaints with us. Here again, you know, the personal attacks that we've had here in the past two meetings is what has totally discouraged me. I just can't believe what has happened. And, you know, for many, many years, the meetings here of Aiken City Council has been a very orderly, a very smoothly run machine, and I think that's the way it needs to go forward in the future.
Thank you for those comments.
Mr. Mayor, I just want to bring up one little minor point, and that is that when this is reprinted for the general public, you may want to take out the part where it says name and address, because we don't require them to give their address.
We need the name, not the address.
Just the name. And I would want to say to any citizen that has a problem with any department that you really could speak with the city manager and see if the city manager couldn't handle that issue for you, and it wouldn't ever have to be that public. I think that would be a good avenue for any, that would be my talk to any citizen who has a problem with a department or a department head, is to just talk to the city manager and see if the city manager can't handle that for you.
Okay.
But I think these are some good thoughts.
I'm sorry to just have a final comment, Mr. Mayor, in terms of our citizens and our time, and I think we've been more than generous with the time that we've allocated to our citizens to share their concerns with us. And and I've heard that from citizens in the community. And I think that we, even though we are given a, we're saying 5 minutes is what I'm hearing, that will be flexible because we want to make sure that we hear the citizens' input. We're fortunate that we've arrived to the point in our town that people are no longer intimidated by coming to city council. And that took a while for this all-American city to have people in the community to not be afraid to walk into these chambers and speak. And certainly if they come in here where there's hostility and name-calling, they'll be reluctant about sharing what's on their mind. You've got some folks that are really timid and intimidated by the presence of City Hall. So I'm happy to hear the word respectful, being respectful of each other. That's very key as far as I'm concerned. And I think that this beginning of this policy is very good for all of us.
Thank you, Leslie. I've got a couple of quickies. Don, your point about the manner in which people communicate or speak is so important. It is. Many, many times, you know, if someone would just talk to you in a nice, respectful manner, you can get something done. Sometimes you're more inclined to jump on it and do something about it than you are the other way. Sometimes. I want our citizens sitting there that certainly do these things properly and get up and say what they want to say, and that is most of our citizens. I would say 99% maybe of our citizens that come here to speak understand. They prepared and they get up and speak, sit down, no problem. So it's not the bigger majority by any means. And Leslie, as you mentioned, flexibility. Certainly will be flexible. Certainly will be flexible. And if council desires, you know, someone else to come up and speak again or has questions, certainly we can do that. We're not trying to cut people off. We're just trying to limit a little bit, maybe, to get our meetings back to where they should be for an all-American city and a character city. We need to act like that. And we can work together. We can get a lot more accomplished in a shorter period of time. And so, any other comments on this? As I hear what you're saying, we'll continue with this. We can modify it as we go, as we need to, as council sees fit. You know, is that what I'm hearing?
Yes,
is that basically? Okay. Okay, moving right on now. First item under new business is first reading of an ordinance to amend the business license ordinance regarding verification of gross receipts. Mr. Pierce, please.
Thank you, Mayor. The title of the ordinance is an ordinance amending section 12-35 of the Aiken City Code. Council's aware that this is our business license ordinance. The modifications we're making to section 12-35B are removing the sentence that says, now it's removing this sentence, applicants may be required to submit copies of portions of state and federal income tax returns reflecting gross income figures. That language would come out of the code section, and in place of it would be added, applicants may not be required to submit copies of portions of state and federal income tax returns reflecting gross income figures at the time of filing this form or annual renewal of the business license. This ordinance is before you on first reading and follows the vote by council to remove the policy of requiring the gross receipts verification at the time of filing a business license application or renewal form, and this would codify that change in the business license code of the city of Aiken. So on first reading and consideration is this ordinance to amend the business license ordinance regarding verification of gross receipts to remove that requirement.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Do we have a motion and a second? And then we'll ask for discussions, and anyone want to speak on the issue may do that.
I'll make the motion to approve the change eliminating the requirement to submitting the portions of the state and federal income tax returns.
Second.
Second?
No. Yes.
Okay.
Would anyone like to speak on this issue?
I have a comment, two comments. Where it says applicants may not be required to submit copies, I just assume it say applicants shall not be required to submit copies. In other words, the whole purpose of this is to not require a tax form, so.
Right, that's why we took the previous sentence and put it in the negative. That was drafted by the city attorney, so he can comment that on Mr. DeWar. I mean, shall make it mandatory.
Are you reading that as a strict prohibition against requiring tax?
Yeah, we will not be doing that.
Okay, you lawyers always have different.
Well, it's the city attorney lawyer this time. I'm just your city manager.
I like the word shall better than that. The other question I have is, do they really need a Social Security number? I mean, I'm on a tear for that. I hate to give that out to anybody that doesn't need it.
It's a Social Security number or federal employment identification number. We have to have that to identify that business. It's strictly confidential. But we have to have that to identify the business. See, if it's a sole proprietorship, it will be a Social Security number. And if it's a business that gets a federal ID number, then we just use that number.
Whose Social Security number do you have for Walmart?
No, that they use a federal employee identification.
So you would have their federal ID number?
FEIN, right.
Okay, all right.
The
business has a federal ID number. Anyone
in the audience like to speak on this issue? There'll be another opportunity. Okay, we have a motion and a second. All in favor? Show of hands. Okay, passes unanimously. Okay, very good. Item 2, first reading of an ordinance regarding payment due dates to the City of Aiken that fall on weekends or city holidays. Mr. Pierce, please.
Thank you, Mayor. This ordinance is simply titled An Ordinance Amending Section 2 of the Aiken City Code. In our discussion about the business license and verification of gross receipts, it came out in the discussion that sometimes we have deadlines for city payments that are due, and it turns out to be a Saturday or a Sunday or maybe even a legal holiday where it's impossible to appear in person and pay that fee that is due. So we're adding a section to the city code to provide as follows. In the event a payment for city services, city taxes, or city fees is due to the city on a date that falls on a Saturday or Sunday or a date that is a city holiday, then that payment shall not incur a penalty provided the full payment is made before 5 o'clock p.m. on the next business day following that weekend or holiday. And that's for consideration on first reading.
Okay, thank you, sir. Do we have a motion and a second on this?
I so move, Mr. Mayor, that we approve this ordinance on first reading.
Okay, we have a second. Anyone like to speak on this item?
I have a comment.
Okay.
Our holidays, our city holidays, don't match up with the federal holidays. For example, to my dismay, Veterans Day is not a city holiday.
It's a floating holiday for city employees,
so
but
what
we
I
would be open, Mr. DeWar.
So what I would suggest to eliminate any confusion on the people who, so they don't have to remember just our holidays, that we say that is a city or federal holiday. Is that acceptable?
We would be open to accept payments, though. It's the city holidays when the offices were closed, I understood, was the problem. That's why we drafted it this way.
I understand. So the way it's written now, you better know the city holidays, the heck with the rest of them.
Well, I mean, we certainly publish those. We publish it in the newspaper, it's on the website, so that information is available.
Well, okay. I just think it could be better worded.
Do we know offhand which federal holidays are not city holidays? Other than Veterans Day,
I'm not sure I have that list.
They're listed in the benefit package. I thought we had. I thought I saw them there.
Less.
I saw them in the benefits.
Mr. City Attorney, are we say this doesn't? Does this apply to any holiday that the city honors?
The purpose, Mr. Abner, is if the customer comes to the City of Aiken to pay their bill, whether it's on a Saturday or a Sunday or a holiday that the city is closed, and they get to the door and the door's locked. The purpose is to give them until the next day to pay it. That's what I understood was the gist of the citizens' concerns at the last council meeting.
Right, and so
if they come to the city to pay the bill and the door's locked, they got till the next day to pay.
Okay.
Unless they came after 5 o'clock.
I understand, but still this applies to any holiday that the city's closed, whether federal, state, or local.
That's correct.
The city holidays where we are closed, New Year's Day, Martin Luther King birthday, Good Friday, Memorial Day, Independence Day, Labor Day, Thanksgiving Day, and Christmas. So those are the days when we're closed.
But not Veterans Day and not Columbus Day.
Mm-mm. Not the presidential birthdays. Not the day after Thanksgiving. I mean, we're open. No, we're not. We're not open. The Friday after Thanksgiving, we're not open. So that would be a
nevertheless,
city holiday.
You still have one day after that to come pay your bill.
That's right.
No.
Yeah, it's only the city holidays that are applicable to this. Only the city holidays.
Right. That's
you're
the
open on Veterans Day, so
right.
Even though the rest of the country is celebrating that as a holiday, the city of Aiken is not. So the business people or anybody who owes a payment, even a citizen who's trying to make a water payment or what have you, has to understand that just because it's Veterans Day, the rest of the country, it's not a holiday.
I think most businesses are open on Veterans Day.
Yeah.
I know.
Just like the bank. Well, the banks may or may not be able to depend on the holiday, but the point is like the water bill payment typically would not be due on Veterans Day.
Okay. All right, well, try to make my point respectfully.
Okay, any other? We've got motion and second. Any other comments? If not, show of hands, please, all in favor. Passes unanimously. Item 3 is the first reading of an ordinance to provide for partial transfer of conducting municipal elections in the Aiken County Registration and Elections Commission. Mr. Pierce, please.
Thank you, Mayor. This ordinance is entitled an ordinance providing for the partial transfer of the authority for conducting the municipal elections to the Aiken County Registration and Elections Commission. Pursuant to past practice, when we've had a city election in order to contain our costs, we've worked in cooperation with the County Elections Commission to have our ballot items included in the ballot equipment that they have for the voters when they come to the booth. That's worked very well for us, and this is merely a continuation of that practice. This is a memorialization in writing of who is doing what in the upcoming elections. And of course, we've got 3 council members up for election in November. So this agreement is in order for us to do that in tandem with the county. And this is consideration on first reading.
Now we're transferring duties to the county, right?
Right, because they would set up the machines and have the polling places.
So there's no difference? We're just putting it in writing?
We put it in writing in the past. We're just doing it because we got an election coming up this year.
Okay. All right. Do we have a motion and second?
I move for approval, Mr. Mayor.
Second, Mr. Mayor.
Second. Any discussion?
Yeah, this only applies on the list of elections that you've given us where we start to sign up in August. This ordinance that we're approving tonight only applies for the general election because the parties run the primaries?
That's right.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Yeah, this is for the November.
And do we have any idea, we ought to have an idea, about the cost that it is going to be for this?
Do you know, Ms. Rideout, based on past elections, an approximate number?
$4,000 to $8,000.
And it is in the budget, so we have budget money.
Yeah, I know we have $25,000, but these are the same things we've always paid for.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Okay, we've got a motion and a second. Any discussion? If not, show of hands, please. All in favor? Passes unanimously.
Mr. Mayor, I didn't get who seconded the motion.
I did.
Okay, thank you.
Item 4, election schedule for city council elections for 2011. Mr. Pierce, please.
We presented a proposed schedule for the elections in November, including the opening for nomination petitions and entry of candidates for primaries. Richard Johnson is here. He's the chair of the Elections Commission. In case council has any questions about the election schedule, but this is typically done according to the provisions under state statute that we have to follow. Of course, with the U.S. Census taking place last year, we are going to have new census figures, and we're already in conversation with the folks at the state level for any redistricting that may be necessary to be approved prior to the conduction of the elections. But this is just a presentation for receipt of information of the proposed reelection schedule that's being proposed by the Election Commission.
Okay. Mr. Johnson, would you like to say anything? If you certainly may. And we appreciate all the many years you've been chairman of this Election Commission.
To Mr. Mayor and Council, I do not have anything different to offer, but this is a regular schedule, and we will follow this schedule for the election, except if something develops because of the census, there might be some changes in these dates, but otherwise, this is correct.
Okay, sir. Thank you very much. And again, thank you for your service. Do we have a motion and a second?
I move we accept the schedule as presented.
Second.
Okay. Okay. Any discussion? If not, show of hands, please. All in favor? Okay. Item 5, approval of bids for the Jewelers Loop storm drainage improvements and for Hitchcock Woods sanitary sewer line improvements. Mr. Pierce, please.
Unfortunately, Mayor, from time to time we have some occurrences that can't wait until we budget and have the budget approved each year. We've got two instances here. You've got a memo from Larry Morris, who's our Director of Engineering and Utilities Department. The first project involved sanitary sewer improvements in Hitchcock Woods. Based on the information that we've provided you, we had some gabions that washed out. We replaced those. They washed out again. And unfortunately, a sewer pipe was exposed in the Sand River area of the woods. We've gone out to bid. The recommendation is to accept the bid of Gene Ray Fulmer for $160,434. That's on the Hitchcock Woods project. The second is a storm drain pipe that has failed behind the Jewelers Loop that's on Richland Avenue West in town. We went out to formal bid and received a low bid from Southeast Pipe Survey in the amount of $215,800. The good news is we do have special holding funds available to cover these expenses, and these were unforeseen circumstances that have arisen. We do need to address them. Otherwise, there's potential for serious harm to these areas of the city. So we're before you today, since they're not a budgeted item, to have approval of those two bids so we can proceed with the contracts and the construction work.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
However, council wants to handle it. Council Member Homoki was asking if it was two separate votes or not. We can just present it as both projects for approval.
One is okay.
The council wants to split up.
Let's do it as one.
One. I agree.
Do we have a motion and second?
So moved, Mr. Mayor.
Second.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion? If not, show of hands, please. All in favor? Passes unanimously. Under new business, approval of the bids. Hey, we did that.
We just approved that.
Seven, review the city employee benefits. Mr. Pierce, please.
Thank you, Mayor. One of the council goals that were adopted this year was to conduct a comparison of the city employee benefits package and compare that with other South Carolina cities. We have, since the adoption of that goal, gone to other cities in South Carolina and compiled the information that we presented to you in the report tonight. We have had a presentation about the city pension plan in the past. We do have Warner Anthony back with us here today to answer questions that you might have about the pension policy. And the information that's presented shows how we compare with other South Carolina cities regarding a wellness program, the health insurance benefits, the pension and retirement plan, the days off, the other benefits that we provide, including life insurance and the city nurse, short-term disability, our continuing education program and employee assistance program, the uniforms we provide for our employees. As your city manager, the one thing in working on this particular project that as I went back through the archival files that council has historically wanted to have employees who would come and work for us for a very long time. The benefits package that you have before you tonight is a benefits package that's been in effect for a number of years. We funded it through the budget process and we reviewed it as part of the zero-based budgeting process last year. This benefits package is something we consider to be particularly attractive in keeping employees here for a period of time. Council has expressed concern on several occasions about having folks that would work with us for a long time, also making sure that we were training folks to assume positions of supervisory authority or just that wealth of knowledge to pass that along to others who will come in. And the benefits package has proven to be quite helpful for us in attracting those new workers as well as encouraging workers to participate in the succession management program and have aspirations for, you know, higher positions of authority and responsibility in the city. So with that, I wanted to present that for information tonight. If there are particular questions that council has, we can certainly address those and provide additional information.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Comments?
Yes. Mr. Mayor, first let me say my focus on this is twofold, is to make sure that given all that we're reading about these days about unfunded pension liability and so forth, to make sure that we have what we were able to deliver, what we promised to our employees, and that is a well-funded retirement plan that will be there for them to collect. I think we're reading around the country of municipalities and states that have failed to make the right payments and find themselves in a bind. And this is an obligation that the city has to this trust. There's no way we can avoid it. And if it's not funded properly, then taxes or bonds have to be raised or bonds have to be issued. I appreciate the opportunity to be able to discuss it. And the same vein, the other issue, of course, is to make sure that whatever we provide to our employees, as the city manager has said, is fair in comparison to other municipalities, but is also fair to the taxpayers. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to ask more questions because it's a very complicated area. Every time I look at it, I spent the weekend reading every page of the budget plan and every page of the handout that's given to the employees to understand it, and I learned a great deal, and it generated a lot of questions. So I don't know how you want to handle the questions. I'll just ask them.
If it's helpful to council, since we're focusing in on the pension plan, we've actually had a pension plan in the city since about 1961.
Mm-hmm.
That's gone through several different versions. And, of course, in 1995, we had the current pension plan, and I think you looked at that most recently in January.
Yes.
It's under several restrictions, including the Government Accounting Standards Board, as far as how we handle the plan, how we fund the plan, how we report the plan. And your current pension plan for our city employees is audited every year. It is part of the audit. We do put it in the comprehensive annual financial report that we publish on the website for the city of Aiken. There are additional safeguards involved in the pension plan. I am the chair of the retirement committee with the city under the plan document, and there are two other members, Kim Abney, who's your director of finance, and then Al Cothran, who's our revenue administrator, and we act as the committee. Those appointments to the committee are approved by city council. Any changes to the plan, as we did in January, always come before city council for consideration. And again, you were required by state law to bring you an annual audit. The pension plan is prominently described in the audit document to make sure that it's meeting the requirements of state law as well. We do have the pension attorney, Warner Anthony, from Greensboro, North Carolina, who is here tonight. And, Mr. DeWar, depending on the nature of the questions you have about the pension plan, I'm sure he's...
Oh, absolutely.
He's going to be willing to answer those for you.
Come on up, Mr. Anthony.
But before he comes up, just to explain to City Council, we contribute approximately $1 million a year to the pension plan. Now, before we start asking questions to Mr. Anthony, I just want to clear up some misconceptions based on some comments that have been said to me, and I'm sure Council probably has heard them out on the sidewalk. It is true that the taxpayers pay taxes, and a portion of those proceeds are used to make our contribution to the pension plan. We contribute about 12% a year of salaries to the pension plan for the retirement benefit. But something that we need to be very clear about, as you talk to folks that served on council years and years ago, the thought behind the pension plan was always kind of part of what we've heard as a classic three-legged stool, where someone's Social Security payment, someone's personal savings, and then someone's pension payment would put them roughly in the position they had when they were working and had a salary coming in. With the pension plan that we have, we fund, and you see in the report you have to you before you tonight, it depends on when somebody retires, but typically it's somewhere from 50 to 55% of their pay would be their pension payment. So with that in mind, Warner works with our actuaries with the pension plan. He reviews the investments that are being made and makes sure that we are complying with the plan requirements. We had an opportunity back in the 90s to join the state retirement plan, had a discussion with them, and they told us a figure that would take for the city to then join that state plan. And we talked about it at the time. I wasn't working here, but we went back to the state and said, okay, we're ready to do that, and they changed the contribution amount. So it was too high a figure, and we did not join the state plan. We decided to go with a city plan. And there was just a editorial last week about, depending on the discussion, the state pension plan has an IOU as much as $13 billion in the cabinet. So all the cities that have participated in that state plan have a reason to be concerned. We have not participated in the state plan, so we have a pension plan that has a value. It has cash on hand. We have money to pay benefits, and as Warner will explain, by working with the actuaries and the contribution we make every year, we make sure that that will continue to be the case. So it is a funded plan. He presented information to you back in January, and with our pension plan, we have never said, okay, we'll pay that later. We've never had a manana attitude when it came to the pension plan. In fact, we've always had a very conservative approach to it to make sure it was properly funded. Now, in addition to the tax money that goes in, all the city employees, while they do not have a deduction on their paycheck, they do contribute to the plan, because our human resources department conducts salary surveys every year. As part of that survey, we come up with a salary that would be appropriate for that classified position. And we always lower the salary by 6.5%. When I took your job as the assistant city manager, I was told that the salary level was a certain rate. That was being reduced 6.5%. because of the money that goes into the pension plan. So while we contribute 12% each year of salaries into the plan, the employees are actually already contributing 6.5%. That goes into the plan, and in effect, the additional money is 5.5%. But the plan has been successful since its inception in 1995. I know we talked about the actuarial target of 8% return on the money. But if you look at the inception of the pension plan through today, it has earned 7.6%. Now, of course, there have been ups, and there certainly have been downs. We had 9/11, and we had the financial reverses of 2008, and that shows up in the plan. But this pension plan has been over a period of time. So by looking at the long haul instead of day trading, the plan has earned the money that it's needed to earn in order to meet its obligations. We have an investment firm that makes the recommendations for the investment of the monies that are in the pension fund, and then we also have a custodian that actually makes the investments. So there are several safeguards in this pension plan. It is a trust fund. So when that money goes into the pension plan, it stays in the pension plan. We can't borrow it to balance the budget. It just simply cannot be done. We have the safeguards of city council through the audit, making sure the plan has stayed reasonably liquid. And we also have the checks and balances of not only the retirement committee, but the investment advisor and the custodian of the money, followed up by Mr. Anthony, who is the legal advisor for this plan and has been since it was started in 1995. So with that, Mr. DeWire, I just wanted to provide that background information to clear up any misunderstandings that may be out there, and Warner, let you do the legal work at this point.
There's no negative misunderstandings, I want to assure you. You said you're the chairman of the retirement committee, and that's appointed by council. When were you appointed?
It's under the pension plan that you approved. The city manager is
so
the
city
chair
manager by title.
By title.
Okay.
That's right.
I would just quibble with one thing you said, because we went through zero-based budgeting, and, mm-hmm. and until last week, I had never heard the wage survey, the salary surveys, they were discounted by 6.5%. I'd never heard that. It was never mentioned to us in zero-based budgeting. And I went back and I looked at the minutes. I flat didn't see it. I know Mr. Crook was there, although the minutes didn't indicate that he was, but he was. But we have just never have seen that. So I think
right.
on the surface, I hope you understand the concern.
Oh no!
Because without making that statement, it seems like an overly a difficult plan for the taxpayers' benefit. What kind of reports do the employees and the council receive on the benefit plan? I looked at a document. I think that you had signed, Mr. Anthony. That I don't know. Was that document? I have it someplace here, but.
What we do provide, if it'll help,
yeah.
Mr. DeWire,
what do
we do provide
employees?
The employees every year a calculated Social Security benefit, and then based on their current salary level, a calculated pension plan benefit.
Okay, and
it's called an annual benefit statement. It shows mm-hmm. for each person based on their salary and their service to date and projected date what their retirement benefit would be.
And the Social Security portion of that, would that essentially be the same as they would see if they got a benefit earning statement?
I don't have a copy of that statement. I don't believe that it shows the Social Security benefit. I think it just shows the plan benefit. I don't believe it shows the Social Security.
But we need to put in.
It shows the Social Security.
It does show
the Social Security benefit. Now, it's not to the exact dollar. It's very close.
Yeah,
our experience has been with that annual statement that they're provided, that if the person actually retires, it turns out the Social Security benefit is very close.
Yeah. But the actuary prepares that statement. So they will just look at their average annual salary and do a projected Social Security benefit based on that.
Okay, but our funding has to include that Social Security payment should the employee elect.
No, it does not. So the plan benefit is completely separate from the Social Security benefit.
They calculate the Social Security benefit so that the employee will know, I can kind of expect Social Security to be this, and then I know the pension payment.
The city's obligation under the plan is just the plan formula, which has nothing to do with Social Security. The Social Security is an additional benefit paid by the federal government.
But not until you're 62.
That'd be the earliest.
Yes. But if an employee retires with 30 years at age 55, we are going to pay that the employee has the option of receiving what they would receive in Social Security at age 62 for 10 years until
that's really I think that there's been a tremendous misunderstanding, I think, of this Social Security optional form of payment. May I just take a moment?
Yes, oh, please. I'm glad you're here.
Because that is not an additional benefit, okay? It is not an additional benefit at all. It is the same economic benefit as the accrued benefit for each person. What you start with under the plan is the formula, which is final average pay times years of service, and let's just assume 30 years of service, that is 55%, because it's 1.82%. Mm-hmm. So it's 55% of pay. So let us assume that someone is making, I'm pulling numbers out of the air, so I may not be dead to the penny. Let's assume someone's making $30,000 at the time they retire. So let's just assume that their retirement benefit under the plan formula is $15,500 a year for life. That is what the plan promises to pay them. Now, that person has an option of how they want to take that money. Let's assume we have three people who are retiring, all of whom had the exact same compensation, all of whom had the exact same service. They each have a benefit of $15,500 a year for life. Let us assume one of the individuals is not married, has no children, has no nephews, doesn't have anyone he wants to leave any other money to, he or she leaves any other money to. That person says, pay me $15,500 a month for life. And when I die, I don't get anything else. Let us assume the second person is married, wants to provide a retirement benefit to him or her and the person's spouse for the life of both parties. The actuary looks at the life expectancies of each party and says, for you, that $15,500 a month calculates into maybe a $12,000 per year, I said per year benefit for you and your wife. So that person retires and takes $12,000 a year, and they'll be paid for the life of that person and that person's spouse.
So when he dies, she's going to get $12,000.
She's going to get that for her life, now it's $12,000. So, but it was still the same benefit.
Sure.
Let's assume the third person is a little younger and says, I want to have equal retirement now and even after I get my Social Security. So what I'd like to do is get more money per month at the beginning and less money per month after age 62. So let's assume the person is 57 years old. So the actuary says, I look at the $15,500 a year economic benefit. If I accelerate that, so I will pay that person a larger benefit for the first 5 years and a smaller benefit after 5 years, what is the present value of that? It's just a question of taking an interest rate, taking a time value of money. So that person might get let us say, $20,000 a year benefit for 5 years, and then the benefit may drop from the plan to $10,000 a year. So it's not, the plan is not giving a higher benefit, it's just the time value of money and how it's paid. Each of the three people get the exact same economic benefit. It's just that each person gets to elect the form in which that benefit is paid.
Okay, and then could you briefly describe, there's two other options for, what is it, 10-year or 15-year survivor benefits?
Right.
Could you?
Right. I mean, I just picked three of the
options. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, but okay.
But I had questions on those as well.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
So you have, in addition, you have a life only with 10 years guaranteed or a life only annuity with 20 years guaranteed. Now, because your life expectancy at the retirement age is still past 20 years, there's a small reduction in your value. That $15,500 for life, if you say, if I die in the first 10 years, I want payments to continue for a total of 10 years, so the actuary may say the present economic value of that benefit, instead of $15,500, may be $14,900. And the value for 20 years, instead of $15,500, may be $13,200. It's just an economic value looking at life expectancies and the likelihood that you might die within the first 10 years or first 20 years.
And those payments are guaranteed payments. Are they made to an estate? Or
you would name a beneficiary.
But if the beneficiary dies, are the payments...
It would then be paid to the estate.
To the estate, okay. That's what I thought. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. I got a bunch.
Is there a cost of living allowance increase as the individual?
There is not an automatic cost of living. The city determines year to year whether to grant a cost of living and how to grant a cost of living. That is a separate determination that is made on a year by year basis.
When you say city, would that be the council?
Is that Richard? I don't know. It's brought to council. Is
yes,
that an internal?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. With regard to replacement rates, it seems as though the replacement rates for the, for lack of a better word, just the mathematical, for lower wages is higher, or is lower than it is, or maybe higher than it is for the higher wage earners.
That is because that's the nature of Social Security. So, I mean, the plan, some plans are written what's called integrated with Social Security, where you set a benefit and then reduce it by a portion of the Social Security benefit. This plan is written without regard to Social Security. The formula is very similar to the state's formula, written without regard to Social Security. So the plan pays a benefit, and then the person also will receive their Social Security. And of course, Social Security benefits as a percentage of replacement income are substantially higher for lower wage earners than they are for higher wage earners. In fact, the Social Security says, you know, that they for a lower wage earner, you could have a Social Security replacement ratio of 50%, while you have someone who's making over $100,000, the Social Security replacement ratio may be 20%. So that is the nature of Social Security, that when you add to it, so higher wage earners are not going to get as high of a replacement ratio as lower wage earners, although we've tried to work it out so that the studies for replacement ratios say that lower wage earners need a higher replacement ratio. You have someone who's making $25,000, they almost need 100% replacement ratio, while someone who's making $100,000 may not need quite as high of a replacement ratio to maintain their standard of living.
Does everyone in the plan have the Social Security option to age 62? I sort of sense that the higher wage earners can go till 65.
There is a separate benefit formula. About 7 or 8 years ago, because of the issue that the higher wage earners have a lower replacement ratio than the lower and middle wage earners, about 7, 8 years ago, a council approved an additional formula to the plan for the higher wage earners to get them to the same replacement ratio that basically uses a Social Security offset approach. So it gets them to the same replacement ratio, and what it does is it gives them, it actually reduces their benefit by the full Social Security benefit when they become eligible for their normal Social Security benefit.
And we talk about normal Social Security benefit, which is now, I believe, 67?
It is whatever the person's normal Social Security retirement age is. And it depends on your age. Yes.
Have you seen any, and I know it's kind of iffy, but have you seen any projected studies in your industry that of how we're going to deal with future changes in Social Security? I know it's probably guessing at this point.
No one in the pension industry has been willing to make any projections that if there are major changes in Social Security, there will be major changes in plan designs.
Would you expect that to happen?
Based on the economic factors of the country, I expect to see some changes in Social Security. Yeah. I think many people are feeling is that, I mean, what you're hearing is they're probably going to grandfather people 55 and older. Mm-hmm. And if they do that, I think many of the people in the pension industry say, well, we got, 5 or 6 years to figure out what to do. But it will require some major reviews of the whole design of retirement plans.
Is there an assumed inflation rate for pension plan? Obviously, everybody's worried now about inflation.
You mean a cost of living?
No, inflation rate. Right now, inflation, I think, is what, about 1% or 2%?
Going up
significantly with the increase in oil price?
If inflation takes off, unless the city council approves cost of living increases, there's no built-in inflation protection.
Okay. And in our our consolidated financial report, there was one, and it's on page 54. Do you have it with you?
Yes, I do. I do. Let me turn to page 54. I copied portions of it, and I went from page 52 to 56.
Good.
So I did not have 54.
I've got page 54.
Is the general fund.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, the general fund.
Yeah.
The last column where it says the, unfunded FAAL, is a funded liability, the last column.
Variance with budget? Or maybe we're not on the same page.
Sorry.
Page 54 or 56.
We have different pages.
Do I have the wrong year?
I got the wrong year. That's the problem.
Okay. This one right here.
That's the one here. I've got a question here, and the other question I have is that number.
Okay.
Even though our documents will have different numbers, my questions aren't that critical to the actual number that's there.
Okay.
Warner, I'm sorry, Mr. Dalton, but if you could just read the page number you're reading off of into
page,
the rest.
It's page 56 and 58. Of the current report, yes, sir. The UAAL as a percentage of covered payroll.
Yes. What should we want to see in that column? I mean, I know you're happy with the plan as we have, but in 08, which is the latest number that I have, it was 26%. Is that a good number to have?
I would do not focus on that as a percentage of covered payroll. The purpose of that is to say, if it's real high, then you're in trouble because your obligations to put in as a percent of payroll are really high. They should be the lower is better. I more focus on the assets and the liabilities in the plan is what I focus on.
And at the bottom,
what you had said at the very beginning about plans that were in trouble, that arose because people failed to make the contributions each year. They just took contribution holidays, or they substantially increased benefits, and thirdly, big drops in assets. So if you're looking at the totality of assets and liabilities, for the rule of thumb, the Boston Research Council think tank that does a lot of work on government plans says that government plans funding somewhere between 80 and 90% is really, really good. Now, if you're horribly underfunded, then you want to look at your funding as how badly that is as a percent of payroll, because that gives you some idea of your ability to make up the difference. This plan has always been really well funded, so I'm not worried about as a percent of payroll. When the market collapsed in 2008, the plan's funding went down a good bit, but that has pretty much come back. It's back to where it was at that time. So from your actual assets and your liabilities, you're still in very good shape. The actuarial report will not show that for a couple of years, because the actuarial report does an averaging of several years of assets. So you're contributing at this higher rate. In 3 years, when you come out of that, you're going to go probably going to be close to 100% funded, assuming we don't have some other drop in assets.
Sure.
And go ahead, your next question.
Yeah, the bottom page, or at the bottom of that same page, percent contributed, we want to see that. We like to see three numbers on that, at least 100%.
Yes, yes. You have contributed every year. When you say you have fully funded your annual contributions every year. And right now, part of your annual contribution is amortizing that big loss from investment loss from 2008, which some of it has already been made up.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then the next page, which deals with the other post-employment benefits plan.
Yes.
The number that seemed to worry me here is the funded ratio of 3.9%. Is that a good number?
No, that is a whole different issue. That is your post-retirement medical plan, where you're providing medical benefits to retirees. That has always been in the past been by the city on a pay-as-you-go basis. Has never been funded, and it is only 3 years ago that you started to fund that. So it's going to take you a while to build that.
Okay. Bear with me. I ended up writing a lot of questions that I don't want to waste your time on if they've already been answered.
Well, I do want to answer, everything while I'm here.
And increases in benefits must be approved by the council.
Yes.
Okay. That would be a modification to the pension plan.
I have argued that we don't need to bring every minor little amendment to the council, but the city manager, whoever he has been at every point in time, has always said we bring every amendment to city council.
Okay. And how much is the trust itself, as far as you know right now, not to the penny, but I mean
around $20 million.
Around $20 million. Mm-hmm. And is there a document that shows employees and taxpayers where that's invested?
It's in the audit. That's reported in the audit, and you have it in the CAFR we put online. So that is available, and it is in there.
Yes. Let me find. That's in footnote 9. No.
Maybe footnote 10, actually.
Footnote 10. You're right. Footnote 10.
Kim is saying 3.
Page
36.
That's footnote 10, though, isn't it, Kim?
No.
No.
Oh, yes, I see. Investments. It breaks them down to Treasury, government agencies, corporate bonds, and corporate stocks. Okay. So in broad categories.
Ballpark in terms of risk of bonds and so forth. Is there a guideline for the level of risk that pension money should be invested in?
The committee has given the investment manager guidelines to percents of stocks and percents of bonds, and he moves the money around in accordance with his views of market conditions there. It's somewhere between 40-60, 60-40 range there.
Okay. And I was a little confused in terms of the composition of the average last 3 years. I think when we talk about law enforcement, I clearly get the impression that overtime and everything is counted. But I seem to recall reading in the document for non-law enforcement people, overtime is not included.
That's correct. Okay. It is. You use straight pay assigned there. You don't count actual pay. You use a salary set.
Now, and since you administer the plan, do you get our payroll records so you're able to...
No, the actuary gets the payroll records and will calculate. And actually what happens is the actuary is given the payroll records every year for purposes of doing the valuation. Then when someone retires, they're given the specific payroll information for that person to calculate the benefit.
Okay. I wrote down that we provide lifetime medical benefits for retirees at age 55 with 10 years of service. I don't know how likely that is, whether we've ever had anybody that met that criteria, but does that seem reasonable to you?
It seems, but I don't have the retiree medical plan in front of me, so.
And there's no conflict between, I guess the pension committee does not, the pension committee collects the monies, that's clear. And they oversee the monies that are invested with the actuary.
Well, they're invested with the investment manager.
And that's generally accepted. There's no conflict or anything.
No.
Okay.
No.
Almost done. The plan talked about reports that are made on a regular basis to the Secretary of Labor, Secretary of Treasury. Are those?
This plan does not make any reports to the government.
Okay. And the pension committee is appointed essentially by the plan, from what I heard the city manager say?
Well, the plan appoints a city manager as the head of the committee, and then the city manager can appoints the other members of the committee.
What we've done with those appointments, Mr. DeWar, is bring them to council for approval.
And when we say pension committee, it's the same as a retirement committee?
That's
yes.
Right.
Okay.
It's just the way it's described
same
in
committee.
The plan document.
Yes. Okay. Do we have any anticipation of any significant effects to our medical plan based on the federal medical plan, appropriate called Obamacare? Is that going to affect our plan in any major way?
Probably not. The medical plan pays for medical benefits for early retirement, and then when you reach Social Security eligibility, you have to go own Social Security. So if Social Security is significantly changed, if Medicare is significantly changed, it would require us to figure out what to do.
But then when they go to Medicare, then our plan backs it up.
It becomes secondary.
Okay.
I have a quick question. You cited three examples of that person that made $15,500. Seems to me it doesn't pay to try to work until you're 67. It almost pays to try to get out the first time you are eligible for a retirement.
Not necessarily. Because there is no cap on service, you get additional credit for every year you continue to work. And once you reach, it's 1.8% for the first 30 years, then 2% for all years after 30. So if you're continuing to work and your salary's going up, you're going to get additional benefits due to higher compensation and additional service credits to there. So there is some plans would cap service at 30 years. If that was the case, then I would agree with you. Mm-hmm. So it's for each person. If they want to continue to work and get a salary, they're going to get a salary and they'll get a larger benefit. If they're just worn out, they can retire.
Assuming a person retires at 67, do they still have the option of that survivor's benefit?
The reduced benefits
and then have their significant others collect?
Social Security advance form of payment whereby we accelerate the payments at the beginning and then reduce them more at a later time, that is only for people who take early retirement. Anyone who retires at their normal retirement date would have all the options, a life annuity, 10 years, a life annuity with 10 years certain, 20 years certain, a joint and survivor 50%, a joint and survivor 100%. So they would have all the optional forms. And so the actual money that someone receives is more an investment choice by them of how they want to take their form of payment.
Okay. Two last quickies. Regarding law enforcement, public safety personnel, they contribute 6.5% of their earnings, and do they in fact contribute to that, or does the city pay that 6.5%?
No, the public safety employees are in the state retirement system, and my understanding is that they contribute to that. That is with
they pay 6.5, and then the city pays the 11.66. Did it go up? I think. It says 11.33, but I know it went up recently. The only other comment I would make is on page 6 of what you've given us in our packet, City Manager, our plan is head and shoulders above the rest. I mean, Anderson is 9.1% versus our 12.5%.
Well, you can't just look at the pure cost, because that is reflecting, you know, the makeup of the investment, and you've been very aggressive in funding, so you don't really know in looking at funding. The real way to see head and shoulders is to look at the benefits provided in terms of the cost.
Well, but in terms of contribution, terms of city contribution, Aiken clearly contributes far more than the four municipalities here.
The city actually contributes 5.5%. The employees through the reduced salary are contributing 6.5% of the 12. Yeah,
have you ever come across municipalities? Well, you only deal with us. You don't deal with other municipalities.
Not in the state of South Carolina.
Okay.
Yes.
Because historically, why did we ever discount the 6% from
this? I can tell you exactly why.
Oh, good.
When we decided, when the state raised the ante to join the state system, and it was decided to keep a city plan, and the decision was we want to have the city plan benefit formula be the same as the state benefit formula, because employees had thought we were going into the state system, so they wanted to keep the benefit formula. The city looked at it and said, well, what's it going to cost? You know, and the actuaries looked at it and said, this is going to be somewhere between 9% and 11% of pay. And so the city said, okay, we can charge the employees 6.5%, just like the state. And I said was, if you do that, the only person who's going to benefit from that is the federal government. Because while the 6.5% is reduced from taxable income, it is still subject to FICA and FUTA taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So that 6.5% we subject to something like 15% tax. So by, in effect, reducing the pay at the front end by the 6.5, you've hidden the employee contribution. I mean, so city council or a citizen looking at your budget doesn't see an employee contribution, but it's hidden in that if you, what you did, if we did it, we would increase wages by 6.5% and reduce contributions by 6.5% and send the federal government an extra $50,000 in taxes. So that was why it was done that way, because it would allow the city and the employees. So under this way, a city employee has, the comparable city employee has higher net take-home pay than the comparable state employee because of the FICA and FUTA taxes, plus the city has saved money too.
And the state employee is showing a deduction from the paycheck.
Yes.
Again, the philosophy back in the day was kind of a forced savings for retirement, so it was an encouragement for longevity of service and loyalty to the city.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for your patience. Getting involved in this, I just want to make sure in my own mind that we've got a good plan that's going to be able to do for the employees what we tell them it's going to do. And not being a financial expert, it's difficult to raise your hand and vote and say it's fine. without knowing a lot more, and I can guarantee you I know a lot more about the pension plan than I did 2 years ago. I seem to learn about it every year. It's obviously a credit to folks like you that structured it years ago and have done a good job in contributing to it, and I'm very satisfied at this point that what we're doing is right. Thank you for your help.
All right, and I have to say, Richard has my email address. If anyone has any questions, you're welcome to email me. I'll be happy to respond to you.
Thank you. Don't run off yet.
Just a minute.
Yes.
Question. Comparing then, we had a quick discussion before the meeting. Comparing this, if you will, to the state plan that we so judiciously didn't join, which I'm all for. The 1.28% per year are the average of the last 3 years, and then it goes to 2%. Is that in the state plan also?
Yes, it is.
Oh, I assume that's just a reward for working for 30 years? What is the logic behind doing that? And I come from the corporate world like a lot of us in here, and we're capped at 75% with Social Security at 62.
Yeah, most corporate plans are what's called integrated with Social Security, where the employer certainly takes a credit for the Social Security benefit that the employee is getting. The state, many government plans are not integrated with Social Security, and the net result is the lower wage earners do get a substantially higher replacement ratio. I do not know the basis for how the state devised its formula on that. I just assume that it was in an effort to, just as this gentleman commented, to keep longer service people there, to give them a little extra incentive to stay. You know, after 30 years, you're thinking of retiring. Well, we'll give you 2% of pay, so maybe you might continue to continue to work for a little bit longer.
Now, for the back to the Social Security payment, my understanding is you used to use 60, age 62 for all city employees in Aiken. Now you use age 62 for hourly and 65 or 7 for salary?
No. Restate
what you said.
Okay, two different formulas, completely different. The Social Security form of payment, I mean, all that is a mathematical calculation whereby we accelerate the payment for a fixed number of years and then pay a lower payment for years thereafter. So it's the economic equivalent of the accrued benefit. And we picked 62 because people who are taking early retirement, who are wanting to receive their money, are likely to take their retirement, their Social Security benefits at age 62. The mere fact that we've done that doesn't mean they have to take it at 62. They can take it whenever they want. That's their economic choice. Now, in addition to that benefit, there is a different benefit for people who make more than 60% of the Social Security wage base. It's not an hourly salary component. It's just for people who make more than 60% of the wage base, and those are the people who were having a substantially lower replacement ratio because their Social Security benefits as a percent of pay were lower. In order to get them to the same replacement ratio as the great majority of the Aiken employees, there is a formula like your traditional corporate formula that is a Social Security offset, so that if they take early retirement, they get paid until they reach their actual Social Security age, and at that point, their benefit is reduced by the full Social Security benefit.
Is that part of the state plan too?
No, that is not part of the state
plan. That's only part of our plan,
yes.
Our private plans.
Yes.
And that was voted on 6-8 years ago?
I think 7 or 8
Well,
years
whatever
ago.
It was, yes. Was okay. Now, to the public input, the public, and Mr. Pierce may have to help me, and I'm new to the council here, but how is the public input into how the changes of the plan occur? Does that come annually, like you came here a few months ago and said, these are the changes? If we wanted to increase benefits, you would have brought it at that time, or how does this work?
Exactly right. That would be a change to the plan document, so that would be in a public session in this room.
Yeah, we have made no changes to the plan document and since that last one where 7 or 8 years ago. The only reason we brought this plan document was IRS changes that required us to restate the plan. There were no changes in the document. So City Council, I almost never see y'all because we just don't change the plan.
Okay.
But if there was an interest in changing the plan, it would be brought to City Council.
And again, Mr. Edburn, just so we show, it's not just changes to the plan. We have an annual audit. The pension plan is part of that annual audit. We talk about it then. Yeah.
My concern is, and I trust what everybody's saying, but anything that happens to the plan would come before the public in front of council.
Absolutely, and it does it really when you think about it three different ways. If there was any change to a benefit that would be paid, that would come before council. We come before you in the budget process for the annual contribution to the plan. That's a public meeting, and. So the changes to the plan, the budget, and then again, as I said, the annual audit. That would be part of the audit document that you receive every year. So there's three different opportunities to look at.
One last general question, Mr. Anthony. What other areas of our plan is different, if you will, from the state plan? You know, we pointed out a couple of things.
No automatic cost of living increase. The state has an automatic cost of living increase. The state has a slightly better early retirement provision.
It's just years of service.
Just years of service there. And the state has done a few things to increase some retention or early retirement, some things that we just are not going to do because they don't make sense for the city to do.
You're thinking of the teacher's early retirement incentive?
Right.
So from what if I interpret what you said right, we not only did very well to stay out of that, but we also are a little more economical minded than the state.
Yes, yes.
All right. Excuse me for another question. Can the state, and I asked this at the last time you were in January, can the state come to the city and say, hey, you still got to help pay for all the other cities? Are we exempt from that?
I guess the state legislature could pass most any law it wants on that or how it raised. Let's assume but as the state retirement system is set up now, no. It would require the state legislature to basically impose a tax on municipalities of some sort, and you'll have to talk to your solicitor as to whether they could get away with that. But as it is right now, your public safety officers are in the state retirement. So anything in terms of shortfalls there, they spread among you. But in terms of the general state retirement system plan, as it is now, there's no mechanism for the only people who make contributions are those who participate in it.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
One final. The annual contributions that we make, those are intended to cover as well. I recognize it's de minimis, but to cover the city council retirement plan is?
Yes. The actuary has really not been factoring that in the past because it's such a small number. He's starting to do it now, but that is just a de minimis item.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything else?
Warner, thank you very much for being with us. And you're going back to North Carolina tonight? Oh, good, good. Well, thank you, sir, very much. That is the last item on our agenda.
Do we want a public input for
anybody? Well, certainly. Certainly.
My name is Debbie Nix. Excuse me, I reside at 808 Woodward Street. Because we only have 5 minutes, I'll read these and then I'll email you a list so you can answer these. I hired someone to audit the pension plan. And these are some facts that he gave me. On note 10 in the city's June 20th, 2010 financial statement, the net plan assets lost $29,212. Yet by design, the plan assumes these assets will earn an 8% return for city workers before they retire and even after they retire. With the recent loss and with this 8% projected yield being challenged, if not ridiculed across the nation, when do you think the City Pension Committee should readjust this unwise assumption? The $12 million that's invested in corporate stocks and bonds, I was told that this was not illegal, but highly unadvisable. The annual plan cost to the taxpayers has nearly doubled in 9 years, from $570,000 in 2001 to $1.138 million last year. Over 9 years, this annual cost has grown by 7.4% annually. If our plan is supposed to be yielding an 8% growth, why is it the cost to the taxpayers increasing by nearly the same amount each year? The pension fund is only 85% funded, 3.5 million short as of fiscal year 2010, according to note 10 in your financial statement. With this alarming growth in our cost just noted, and with the last year's loss in return on assets, have you done any projections out into the future as to what the growth in taxpayers' costs may amount to? According to the South Carolina Retirement System figures, as of fiscal year 2009, government employees contributed nearly 41% of their retirement contributions that year. The members of the South Carolina Police Retirement System contributed an average of 38.3%. The financial statements say that you own special retirement benefits, which is for the city council. It's called de minimis, which is Latin of no significance. I think it would be a great idea for the auditor to type in the amount of funded or unfunded actuarial accrued liability amount assigned to you, as opposed to assuring us that it's inconsequential. I know that you guys strive for transparency. I think this would be a great thing to consider. The biggest red flag was the other post-employment benefits health care program. It appears that makes the pension fund look kind of like a Sunday school picnic. Note 12 of your financial statement indicates we are already contributing $2,240,000 in fiscal year 2009 and $2,362,000 in fiscal year 2010 into that plan, and it appears we are off to the races. We found that the city's plan forecasts that health care costs will be decreasing for fiscal year 2010 through fiscal year 2013, and we wonder if that's realistic. We noted that the city contributes anywhere from 20% to 80% of the employees' premiums, depending upon how long they've worked for the city. But worst of all, we see this plan's underfund liability is 6 times as large as the pension plan, standing at $20,800,000 unfunded at the end of fiscal year 2010. What are your plans to make this up, and how much do you plan on assessing us for this? Thank you.
If you would, Ms. Nix, email those to me. We can get those responses and certainly share that with council as well.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, we'll get the answers to each of her questions.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
We've got it on tape. And
absolutely. She's actually offered to email me to the mayor, so we can make sure we answer your question right, not just off the press.
Okay. Anyone else? If not, we stand adjourned. Thank you all for being with us. Hey, one comment, if I may. Public safety has earned a state award as a top organization in the state. And we have a lot of their public safety officers here today. And I just want to say congratulations to you ladies and gentlemen.